Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is July 17th, 2004. Today's session number is MOP 2004-01. Today's speaker is Philip Moat. The lesson for today is Global Environmental Challenges and Solutions, Biblical Perspectives on Global Environmental Issues. Let's listen in.
So, Nat, could you please get us the... My 12-year-old son is up in the balcony doing the AV. Nat, can you... Well, why don't we just do some quick introductions since it's a smallish group. My name is Philip Moat, and I'm a research scientist at the University of Washington. My specialty is climate, and I'm also the state climatologist. And you can just hold it there for a second. It won't advance. Oh, it's going off your screen.
The resolution is too low.
Okay. Well, we can live with it. That's all right.
No, it's some of your pictures are going off.
That's okay. If you can fix it while we're doing introduction, that's fine. So if you wouldn't mind, just say your name and where you're from and one thing you like about the outdoors. So can I start with you, Sue, and we'll work on it now?
Okay, I'm Sue Pumplin, and what else are we supposed to say?
Where are you from and one thing you like about the outdoors?
Okay.
A place you like, or a thing you like to do outdoors, or a feeling you have about being outdoors, any kind of outdoors.
Okay, I'm from Maryland, between Baltimore and Washington. I don't like the summer weather in Washington, so that's not a good thing to talk about. What I really like are rocky seashores, and I love looking in tide pools and seeing all the critters and stuff that you find in tide pools.
My name is Larry, and I'm from Sacramento, and I like the quietness of the outdoors.
Sorry.
I'm Goldie, yes, and I like to listen to the birds if it's quiet enough for that. I love birds.
And where are you from?
Oh, Sacramento.
Oh, also Sacramento.
Okay. I'm Diane, and I'm here at Holden. And I just like the outdoors. I like the beauty, I guess, and the peace.
I am Ed. I live here in Holden. I like rivers, and I like fish.
I'm Bev Bruner from Everett, Washington. And I just, I was born in the mountains in northern New York State, and I just love the mountains. I really, and it was lots of water.
Thank you. I'm Bernhard Murder, born in Puyallup. I lived in Washington most of my life, a little bit more. I love the state, and I love God's country.
I'm Susie Devon, and I'm from Minneapolis, Minnesota. And I guess I like sunrise and sunset in nature.
I'm Cynthia Ingebretson, I'm from Portland, Oregon, and I like a lot of things about the outdoors, but I think what I like most is being in a forest with the green and the diversity of plant life and trees and the ground cover.
I'm Wes Wallstrom, I'm from Bellevue, and there's a rock at a place called Snow Lake, which is just in Snoqualmie Pass. It's an hour hike. Hour and a half, 2 hours from my office, and it's great to leave the office and go up and sit on the rock. And it's just a beautiful lake, and solitude, and quiet, and very introspective place.
I'm Kieran Wallstrom. I'm from Bellevue, which is just a suburb of Seattle. And when I think of the outdoors, it recalls to mind that many, many times we go camping with our kids as children in great state of Washington, and just being in the outdoors was one.
My name is Ruth Jorgensen, and I'm from northern Minnesota, and I really enjoy just being out and whatever activities we can do, hiking, whatever.
Okay.
Ken Jorgensen, I'm from northern Minnesota. I like snow.
Right.
And the quietness of winter.
I'm Jenny Evans from Hibbing, Minnesota. That's northern. I love the boundary waters between Minnesota and Canada. Very peaceful. And also the autumn leaves anywhere.
I'm from northern Minnesota also. As a matter of fact, I'm from the same church as these people. Yep. I like the changes of the seasons and the interrelationship of the nature and people, and I'm really interested in what we can do to preserve it.
And your name?
I'm Sandy Shade. I'm Karen's sister, and I like bubbling water. I love brooks and streams.
I'm Mary Youngquist. I'm from Minnesota, and I like gardening and flowers and just being outdoors in the summertime.
Mark Twain from Belgrade, Indiana, and I like trout fishing because trout have a good sense to only be in the most beautiful place.
Dorothy Bass, also from Belgrade, Indiana, and I love it whenever I get to a place that's dark enough that you can really see the stars.
Oh, I'm Ralph Johnson from another person from Minnesota, and I've already heard the things I like. I like quiet, I like solitude, I love the changing seasons. Except for winter, I'm sorry.
It's too long.
Yeah.
I'm Lori Johnson from Minneapolis, and I love when the sky and the earth meet in the different ways, in the different times of day.
I'm Chris Burns. I love the ocean, I love the mountains, I live in Bloomington, Illinois.
I'm developing an affinity for cornfields. They really are beautiful.
I have to, George Burns, I have to echo that. I'm from Bloomington, Illinois as well. I was going to say mountains, but the shoreline's nice too, but we haven't even. So.
The sky is great. You can see the whole sky where we live. None of it's cut off by mountains.
Those pesky mountains.
Dean Richardson, Northfield, Minnesota. I remember so well 40 years ago next month when we lived in Denver. We were moving to Minneapolis, and I was just so sad to leave the mountains to go back to the Midwest where I was born. And I have to blame it on Lori, but that's another story. Lori's my daughter there. Well, actually what happened, that we lived in the West, sent her back to St. Olaf, and she stayed. So we had to move back to the Midwest.
Did I already ask you here? Okay. And up in the balcony. Name where you're from and something you'd like to do outdoors.
About the outdoors.
Yeah.
Okay, so my name's Nat Boat and I'm from Seattle. And I like the outdoors. I like it when there are laptops in the outdoors.
We have a little sort of scenery slideshow, and then we're going to sing a hymn about creation. So. Why don't you roll the scenery? These are all just slides from Washington. I won't provide a commentary about where they're from. Just part of the beauty of our state.
Washington.
quite a commercial. Yeah.
Yeah.
Virtually all of these are in eastern Washington. That's the Columbia River.
What was the little town?
One was Republic, one was Okanagan. Dry Falls. Moses Cooley. Recognize that?
Mm-hmm.
It's this morning.
That's what
I'm talking about. And this. Anybody know where this is? Right next to the snack bar next to Narnia. I don't remember if I mentioned this. I'm the state climatologist for Washington, and this is one of our remotest weather stations here at Holden Village. The white box is an old what's called a cotton region shelter. That's a temperature gauge. It's no longer used. The little cylinder on the left of it is the current. Yeah. That's the current temperature gauge. And then the precipitation can over here, and hiding behind it is this snow pole. So the snow depth goes up to, I think, 7 feet or so. And then the next one, yeah. This is the graph of the temperature data from Holden. You see it started back when Holden Village became a Lutheran retreat center. And this goes through end of March, but you can look on these average high temperatures and see for mid-July that the average high temperature is about 80, so more like today. The previous 2 days, if you've been here since Saturday, were quite hot, but you see also that it's not unusual for it to get down into the low 40s or even the 30s in July. It's a mountain environment. Okay, Nat, can you just put it to the snow? Actually, go back to hit F7. Just put it to the blank screen. Thanks. And let's, Sue, if you wouldn't mind moving to the piano, we're going to start with number 548. We're just going to sing one hymn at the beginning, and then another one at the end, or two. 548 is "Oh, Worship the King."
Are we going to do all the verses?
There are four? Oh, six. No, let's just do the first four.
Okay.
Anybody else need a hymn book?
Thank you.
Nat, let's go back. Now, I want to give you a little introduction to this class, which I'll be doing this week, and I recognize that many of you will not be at the whole thing, but you'll be at parts of it. And so, by global environmental challenges, what I'm talking about are things that are beyond national. The sequence of that's fine now. Just leave it, please. No, leave it, please. I'd rather just proceed. Thank you. In some ways, the first three quarters or so of this century, with respect to environmental problems, was just sort of coming to grips with it, recognizing that we had the potential to so affect our own environment in ways that we didn't like that we really had to do something about it. So, for example, smog, air pollution in the upper left is one. There you can see the two photos of the same scene with a smoggy day on the left and a clear day on the right. Water pollution, this is obviously so polluted you can scarcely even tell it's water. Strip mining, cutting away, you know, an entire mountain just to dig out the mines, and of course we have a mine here in Holden. Was not a strip mine, but you know, the tailings are, you know, 50 years later are still very ugly and polluting the water and so on. In contrast, okay, so these local or sub-national problems, that they visibly affect the quality of life in the community. We can see them, in some cases, right out the window or smell them. They're very close. Often, there's a single culprit, a single company or a small group of companies that are causing the problem. And all it takes is enough political will to lean on that one company or to create some kind of policy that targets that kind of problem and the problem is solved. And so in a lot of ways, the successes of the 60s and 70s, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, grew out of this distaste for seeing pollution close by. And a number of you remember the Love Canal and all those really horrible examples of pollution gone to an extreme. Can we have the next slide, please? So the difference with global solution with global problems is that they are often beyond our little local area. In fact, in some ways, we can't even see them. Just go to the next slide, please. So, in a lot of cases, they're not even readily visible. They are out there, and you know, we read about them in the paper, but they're not even something that we encounter. And in some ways, in modern America, it's like poverty. We've kind of isolated ourselves from poverty as well, those of us who live in the suburbs especially. Unlike the local or subnational problems, it's not a single company that you can sort of point the finger at. It's often systemic. It's the way we live, the way we use land, the way we get energy and use energy. So it's much more pervasive, much more difficult. And there are also many players. They're not just companies, but it's very much a part of the fabric of our lives. So it becomes very politically difficult to solve these big problems. So the outline for this week, today, we're talking about biblical perspectives on global environmental issues. The hymn that we just sang is a nice encapsulation of some of these themes. Tomorrow, I'll be talking about some success stories, some global environmental problems that have been tackled and to some extent solved. They're not completely solved, but they are what I call success stories. That is acid rain and ozone depletion. These are two problems that were tackled in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. Then we get to some of the really big modern challenges, global climate change. You probably heard about the movie The Day After Tomorrow, which presented one view of global climate change. So that's what we'll be talking about Wednesday. And then Thursday, undoing creation, species extinction, which is an even more lasting problem than these first few. And then finally, to end on a very positive note, I'll emphasize that there are solutions to these global environmental challenges, and that we, the people of God, can and should be part of these solutions. So let's look at some... Hit it again. So let's look at some Bible verses. Can I have one of our volunteers, can you look at Genesis 1 and keep your finger in it, because we're going to keep coming back to it. So Genesis 1, and it's verses 10b, 12b, and 18b. And then, just stay right there, please. Psalm 19, Karen, would you do Psalm 19? And so you'll see we do, even just on this section, we have a couple of encounters with Genesis. And then somebody, 1 Corinthians 10, could you look up 1 Corinthians 10, 25 and 26? And then would you do Psalm 104 and keep your finger in it, because we'll come back to that as well. So 3b, 4, and 13, 15. So let's hear first Genesis 1. The second part of verses 10, 12, and 18. They're
fairly similar.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so from 10, it says, and God saw that it was good. And from 12... and God saw that it was good. And from 18, and God saw that it was good.
Yeah, and there are a couple more like that. On the fourth and fifth days, it's lying. Okay, so who had Karen? Psalm 19.
Excuse me. The heavens are telling the story of God, and the firmament proclaims his handiwork. Day to day pours forth speech, and night to night declares knowledge. There is no speech, nor are there words. Their voice is not heard. Yet their voice goes out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world.
Thank you. Now, just leave it, please. It's really not helping. Thank you.
Which passage in 1 Corinthians?
Okay. Then we go back to Genesis 1:26-30.
Oh, the whole thing. Okay. Then God said, let us make humankind in our image, according to our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the wild animals of the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth. So God created humankind in his image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female. He created them. God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over every living thing that moves upon the earth. God said, see, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is upon the face of all the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit, and you shall have them for food. And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the air, and to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I have given every green plant for food. And it was so.
Eat whatever is sold in the meat market without raising any question on the grounds of conscience. For the earth and its fullness are the Lord's.
And then Psalm 104, 3b to 4, and 13, 15.
You make the clouds your chariots, you ride on the wings of the wind, you make the winds your messengers, fire and flame your ministers. From your lofty abode you water the mountains, the earth is satisfied with the fruit of your work, you cause the grass to grow for the cattle, and plants for people to use to bring forth food for the earth and wine to gladden the human heart, oil to make the face shine, and bread to strengthen the human heart.
Thank you. Obviously, there are a huge number of biblical passages, and what we're doing here is just, I'm trying to group them in themes and to see what emerges, what are some themes about the environment that emerge. And in this set of verses, we see first of all from those verses in Genesis that God created the world and he pronounced it good. There's an intrinsic goodness in the created world. And this is affirmed not just in that Genesis passage, but elsewhere. This goodness of nature is very important because it says something about how we are to treat nature. So part of the our relationship with nature is recognizing its goodness. And then in the Psalm 19 passage, and also which talks about the heavens declare the works of the Lord, it's clear that one of the purposes for creation is simply to praise God. And Jesus refers to this in his triumphal entry in Luke 19, verse 40, where someone says, "Teacher, rebuke your disciples for it's inappropriate for them to be praising you like this." And he said, "I tell you, if they were quiet, even the very stones would cry out." This notion of nature praising God being a sort of an irrepressible way that nature responds to God's goodness in creation. So he gave it a purpose, first of all, to praise him, which of course is one of our primary purposes for existence as well. The second purpose, which comes out in this second set of passages, is that he gave us nature in order to sustain life. And in the hymn that we sang, there's a verse that kind of picks up on the theme in Psalm 104. The last verse talks about the Lord's bountiful care, what tongue can recite. It breathes in the air, it shines in the light. It streams from the hills, it descends to the plain, and sweetly distills in the dew and the rain. So his active, sustaining work of us, his precious children, and of the animals around us is part of what we see around us, the rain falling and the water rushing down, nurturing the plants in the soil, sweetly distills in the dew and the rain. So there's an ongoing aspect of God's creativity that has among its purposes sustaining human life. So it's pretty clear that he gave us nature not as a gift with no strings attached, a gift to run away and destroy if we chose, but a gift to sustain life. Let's go to the next set of verses. So if you wouldn't mind reading again Genesis 1:28, because this highlights one aspect of it, and then Genesis 2:15, and if you could look up Psalm 8 in verses 3 to 8.
God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves upon the earth."
And then Genesis 2:15.
"The Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to till it and keep it."
Thank you.
Okay. "When I look at your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars that you have established, what are human beings that you are mindful of them, mortals that you care for them? Yet you made them a little lower than God and crowned them with glory and honor. You have given them dominion over the works of your hands. You have put all things under their feet, all sheep and oxen, and also the beasts of the field, the birds of the air and the fish of the sea, whatever passes along the paths of the sea. Please.
Thank you. In this set of passages, we hear different, slightly different notions, but the same theme, of God giving authority over the created world to humans. In two passages, we heard the word dominion, that humans have dominion over the created world. We're not equal to it. We have some authority over it. The psalm talks about humans being a little lower than the angels and in authority over the fish and the creeping things and so on. In the Genesis 2:15 passage, there's a pair of words to work and care for the land. In the Genesis 1:28, there's another pair of words that is to fill the earth and subdue it. And I think you could agree that we could kind of check that one off. We've filled the earth and subdued it. There are over 6 billion of us now, and with a few exceptions, you know, those pesky tornadoes and earthquakes and so on, kind of subdued the earth in some ways. So there's the kind of authority, dominion, fill and subdue, but there's also work and care for the land. And these two things are both important parts of the responsibilities that God gave to humans. Let's go on to the next set of passages. Let's see, would you look up Psalm 24, 1 and 2. Is there some? Oh, I'm sorry, we've still got, 104 there. I forgot. So stick with 104. And was there somebody who hasn't done one, who's got a Bible, wants to read one? Okay, so Karen, would you look up Psalm 24, 1 and 2? And would you look up Leviticus 25, 2 to 7?
The earth is the Lord's and all that is in it, the world and those who live in it. For he has founded it on the seas and established it on the rivers.
O Lord, how manifold are your works. In wisdom you have made them all. The earth is full of your creatures. Yonder is the sea, great and wide. Creeping things innumerable are there. Living things, both small and great.
And Leviticus 25.
Speak to the people of Israel and say to them, when you enter the land that I am giving you, the land shall observe a Sabbath for the Lord. 6 years you shall sow your field, and 6 years you shall prune your vineyard and gather their yield. But in the seventh year there shall be a Sabbath of complete rest for the land. A Sabbath for the Lord, you shall not sow your field or prune your vineyard. You shall not reap the aftergrowth of your harvest or gather the grapes of your unpruned vine. It shall be a year of complete rest for the land. You may eat what the land yields during its Sabbath. You, your male and female slaves, your hired and your bound laborers who live with you, for you, for your livestock also, and for the wild animals in your land, all its yield shall be for food.
Thank you. The first passage, the Psalm 24, is a real strong statement that the earth is the Lord's. And so even though he gives humans authority over the created world in some sense, he retains the title. He still owns it. The earth is the Lord's. And in some passages, or in some translations, that Psalm 104 passage refers to all the creatures as his creatures, God's creatures. And making the distinction that even though we have some authority over them, he still retains the title, in a sense, to creation. And then in Leviticus 25, he gives very specific instructions about the land of Israel and how the Israelites are to treat it, they are to give it a Sabbath rest. So he's not saying, here, do what you want with it. He's saying it's a very important part of my creation that the land have a Sabbath rest, that it share in the rest both that God enjoyed after God's work of creation and also that God gave humankind to enjoy once a week. And as we come toward the end of this series and talking about solutions, one of the things we'll find is that God's plan of Sabbath rest plays into the solutions to some of our environmental problems. So this notion of a Sabbath rest, and also incidentally, that passage is immediately followed by Jubilee, which are, you know, there's Jubilee celebration next week. This is a time of resetting the economic and environmental playing field in a way. It's a very radical notion that's put forth in Leviticus. So, Nat, if you could, there's a sort of a summary theme here that God retains the title to the created world. So our last set of verses here. Don't give away the answer. let's see. So who missed out on the last round of? I think we only had three verses last time. Who? Okay, we'll start up here. So why don't you read us Genesis 7, 21 to 23, and you can read Isaiah 24, 1 to 20. It's kind of a long passage, but beautiful. And then Karen, Isaiah 11, 1 to 9, and we'll finish up with the Romans 8, verses 18 to 22.
And all flesh died that moved on the earth, birds, domestic animals, wild animals, all swarming creatures that swarm on the earth, and all human beings. Everything on dry land in whose nostrils was the breath of life died. He blotted out every living thing that was on the face of the ground, human beings and animals and creeping things and birds of the air. They were blotted out from the earth. Only Noah was left and those that were with him in the ark.
Okay, so at the end there you heard the clue to when this happened. Why did it happen? Why did God blot out all living things?
He wasn't satisfied.
He wasn't satisfied with how people were living. He was, in fact, very angry at the wickedness. And so what we see is that as part of punishing humans, all creation suffered. So let's hear Isaiah 24, 1-20.
Now the Lord is about to lay waste to the earth and make it desolate, and he will twist its surface and scatter its inhabitants. And it shall be, as with the people, so with the priests, as with the slaves, so with his masters, as with the maid, so with their mistress, as with the buyer, so with the seller, as with the lender, so with the borrower, as with the creditor, so with the debtor. The earth shall be utterly laid waste and utterly despoiled, for the Lord has spoken this word. The earth dries up and withers. The world languishes and withers. The heavens languish together with the earth. The earth lies polluted under its inhabitants, for they have transgressed laws, violated the statutes, broken the everlasting covenant. Therefore a curse devours the earth, and its inhabitants suffer for their guilt. Therefore the inhabitants of the earth dwindle, and few people are left. The wine dries up, the vines languish, all the merry-hearted sigh. The mirth of the timbrels is stilled. The noise of the jubilant has ceased. The mirth of the lyre is still. No longer do they drink wine with singing. Strong drink is bitter to those who drink it.
The city of chaos is broken down. Every house is shut up so that no one can enter. There is an outcry in the streets for lack of wine. All joy has reached its plenitude. The gladness of the earth is vanished. Desolation is left in the city. The gates are battered into ruins. For thus it shall be on the earth and among nations, as when an olive tree is beaten, as at the gleaning when the grape harvest is ended. They lift up their voices, they sing joy, they shout from the west over the majesty of the Lord. Therefore in the east give glory to the Lord, in the coastlands of the sea glorify the name of the Lord, the God of Israel. From the ends of the earth we hear songs of praise, of glory to the righteous one. But I say, I pine away, woe is me, for the treacherous deal, treacherously, the treacherous deal very treacherously. Terror in the pit and the snare are upon you, O inhabitant of the earth. Whoever flees the sound of terror shall fall into the pit, and whoever climbs out of the pit shall be caught in the snare. For the windows of heaven are open, and the foundations of the earth tremble. The earth is utterly broken, and the earth is torn asunder. The earth is violently shaken. The earth staggers like a drunkard. It sways like a hut in transgression, lies heavily upon it, and it falls and will not rise again.
Thank you.
A shoot shall come out from the stump of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots. The spirit of the Lord shall rest on him, the spirit of wisdom and understanding, the spirit of counsel and might, the spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. His delight shall be in the fear of the Lord. He shall not judge by what his eyes see or decide by what his ears hear, but with righteousness he shall judge the poor and decide with equity for the meek of the earth. He shall strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he shall kill the wicked. Righteousness shall be the belt around his waist, and faithfulness the belt around his loins. The wolf shall live with the lamb, the leopard shall lie down with the kid, the calf, the lion, and the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them. The cow and the bear shall graze, their young shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox. The nursing child shall play over the hole of the asp, and the weaned child shall put its hand on the adder's den. They will not hurt or destroy on all my holy mountain, for the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord, as the waters cover the sea.
I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory about to be revealed to us. For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the children of God. For creation was subjected to futility, not of its own will, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to decay and will obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God.
Thank you. Quite a sweeping set of passages here. Obviously, with the first two, there's very much an image that because of human sin, creation suffers. And in one case, in the case of the flood, it's simply that we are punished together. In the case of Isaiah 24, the prophetic passage, you hear about the Lord is going to lay waste the land, and all of the treachery that led to that punishment, and also the lack of joy, and the people going around in the streets saying, "We've run out of wine," being part of that punishment. And then the more positive spin on that theme, in the second two passages, second pair, the lion shall lie down with the lamb, part of this messianic kingdom described in Isaiah 11 verses 1 to 5, is this very peaceful world where all of the killing that sustains nature now of predators eating prey, that will be done away with, and things will go back to the idyllic world of the garden. And then finally, I love this Romans passage, that creation itself is groaning and waiting for the redemption that comes with Christ's return. And so the theme for these four passages is that the created world suffers because of human sin. In some ways, it suffers directly because of our pollution, which was specifically mentioned in one of the passages. And in some cases, it is merely punished along with us. Sort of like, I don't know if this ever happened to you when you were in school, but you know, the teacher says there's too much noise, and so he or she punishes the entire class, even the ones who were silent. And you feel a little put out if you were the quiet one and everybody else was talking and you get punished anyway. Well, that's precisely what this Romans passage is about, that that creation was subject to bondage and futility, not because of anything creation had done, but because of the bad student sitting next to it, being the humankind. So the summary of these four themes that I at least see in the Bible as respects our relationship to creation. Number one, that God created nature. I think we can agree with that pretty easily. And that he gave it purpose. That God's purpose in nature was, number one, to praise him. And we see that in a number of passages. And number two, to sustain humankind. Second, God granted authority over the created world to humankind for that purpose of sustaining human life. But that was not a blank check. It was not a, go into the candy store and have anything you want. There were limits. And some of the limits were described in some of these passages. For instance, the Leviticus passage about giving the land a rest. God made it very clear that God retains the title to the created world. And then finally, the created world suffers because of human sin. And the flip side of that is it will share in redemption, and creation is eagerly awaiting that redemption. There are other passages that we didn't visit about God will create a new heaven and a new earth. So there will be an even better restored creation. So how... Yes.
In Romans 8, and I don't have the Bible, so I'm going to guess. That's okay. I think it's 8 or someplace in there, 8, 10, something like that. And it says something to the effect, in all things God works for the good of those who love him, and then for interpretation of them, and keep his commandments or something like that. If you read that with what you've read, then you get... You can come to the same conclusion, but with a little different perspective on what it says.
I'm not sure that's in chapter 8.
It's Romans. I'm pretty sure it's Romans 8.
Oh, yes, 8:28.
8:28, okay.
And we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose.
So my point is that it doesn't disagree. I'm not disagreeing at all with what you're saying. I agree with it 100%. But I think that adds a little different perspective on the suffering and redemption aspect of what you're talking about.
Yeah, there's definitely more depth to it as well. It's not just a sort of simple suffering redemption. Yes, good point. Other questions? I want to sort of lead into the rest of the week and wrap up and bring this back to modern environmental problems. So the first thing I think this says to us as humans, very broadly to the human race, is that we have a responsibility to keep creation in good working order, because it is designed to provide what we need. And we'll come to some of the mysterious ways that even now scientists are just unraveling these mysteries of how creation provides what we need on Thursday. The second thing is that it speaks to, and not so much the passages we read here, but other passages that talk about justice for the poor and the oppressed. It's very clear from Scripture that issues of international and intergenerational justice, that is, doing right by people who are far away in time or far away in space, is a very important part of our thoughts about the environment. For example, when we emit greenhouse gases here in the United States, they are going to cause problems for Bangladeshis in 2075. And we don't know those people. And it's hard for us to care for them the way we care for the people that we do know, that we see, that we live with. But there is a call as part of this stewardship of being given authority over nature to consider these issues of justice for people far away in time and space. The third and I think crucial aspect of this, and I'm going to come back to this especially on Friday, is that the people of God have a special perspective by looking at the scriptures and seeing the Word of God describing both the beauty and goodness of creation and also its purpose as distinct from us as created people. We have a special perspective and therefore also special obligations. In fact, many policy decisions are made in a very crudely speaking, in an economic cost-benefit analysis. And when you frame the question in that way, you leave out precisely these intergenerational and international justice issues, which should be very important for a Christian. So we have this special perspective. It complements, and in fact, I think a lot of us would agree, is superior to the usual way of doing things, where we're trying to maximize profit and maximize gross national product and maximize votes and all those other things that can leave behind God's priorities as spelled out in Scripture. And just to kind of illustrate why we're concerned about this, here are some children that I found playing in Holden Village this afternoon, and unfortunately on the far right is Nat holding her baby daughter. Missed out on that one. Let's close by singing a couple more hymns. Does anybody have any questions or comments?
Well, just comment. I think a key word that you've used a couple times is stewardship, and I'm afraid in our society it's lost its original meaning. 20-year-olds that I work with don't even know what it means. Mm. Older folks think of it in terms of we're not tithing enough. I don't think the original meaning of, you know, we don't own it. It's our responsibility to care for creation. Most people don't see that. They don't understand it, and that's not even on this, you know, on the screen. Hope I can make it on Friday. I'm curious, how do you get people to fulfill their responsibilities in stewardship? Yeah, and so it has nothing, I mean, it's related to tithing, but that's not what we mean.
It's easy to sort of check off, well, you know, I give monthly, so I'm doing stewardship, but you're quite right that it's very much beyond that. Yeah, why don't you just leave it on some of the scenery there while we sing let's do 463. This is one that I don't actually know, but it's got lovely words.
Hope you know the
463,
tune.
God who stretched the spangled heavens. Well, Sue's going to help us with the tune. Some of you know this too.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, first and second verses. Some of you tomorrow.